We are a high tax state by any measure, but I think even progressives should be appalled at the extent to which the money's not being used wisely. We can have debates over the proper size of government, but liberals and conservatives should agree that the money that is collected should be used in the most efficient, effective way possible. And one thing we'd like to see is the programs that are no longer fulfilling a purpose should be terminated.
It celebrated its 45th birthday in June of this year. Not bad for a ballot initiative that former Governor Jerry Brown said wouldn't last more than a year. Not bad for a ballot initiative that its detractors predicted would wreak historic economic havoc on state and local governments. Not bad for a ballot initiative that has withstood the onslaught of additional ballot measures, legislation, and legal challenges, all aimed at overturning it or chipping away at it. Since its passage in 1978, Proposition 13 has endured a lot, but still remains unshakably popular with California homeowners. I'm Tony Melandra, NFIB California Senior Meter Manager. We're proud to have this podcast supported in part by Five Star Bank, serving customers through specialized banking solutions for entrepreneurs, business owners, and community leaders in Northern California. Today's guest is unarguably the foremost expert on Proposition 13. And here to talk with him is NFIB California State Director John Kopetek and NFIB's Chief Legislative Advocate Tim Taylor. Take it away, gentlemen.
Thanks so much, Tony. I am thrilled to have joining me in the studio today NFIB's Chief Legislative Advocate and Small Business Stormtrooper under the Capitol Dome, Tim Taylor. Tim, great to have you with us today.
Great to be here, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun. Hey, our guest today is a very dear and special friend to NFIB and small business, a great and fierce fighter for Main Street and for taxpayers and the citizens of our great state, Jonathan Kupal, the president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association since 1998. With offices both in Sacramento and Los Angeles, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association is the largest taxpayers association in California with a membership of, get this, over 200,000. Wow. The organization was founded by the late Howard Jarvis, the author of Proposition 13, which to this day reins in property tax increases on homeowners, seniors, small businesses, all of us. Great, great legislation and policy. From 1991 to 1998, Jonathan served as the organization's director of legal affairs. Before that, and following law school at William & Mary, he was an attorney for 9 years with the Pacific Legal Foundation. A little bit of his background and Jarvis's background. John Kupal and Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association are synonymous with tax fighters. He successfully defended Prop 140, the state's term limit initiative, before the California Supreme Court. In 1995, he won a major ruling before the court when it upheld Prop 62, the right to vote on local taxes. And he's the principal drafter of Prop 218, the Right to Vote on Taxes Act. Jonathan has chaired the campaign against Prop 88, the statewide parcel tax initiative, and he successfully defeated Prop 1A. And together, NFIB was proud to work with John and HJTA to defeat Prop 15 a few years back, which would have decimated, and make no mistake, decimated Prop 13. Jonathan Kupal, the fierce tax fighter of California, welcome to NFIB's Small Business Podcast.
Well, John, it's always a pleasure. I mean, I think you and I have been in so many battles where we can compare scars these days. But we, you know, as you say, we have fought this fight for 40. Actually, this week was the 45th anniversary of Proposition 13. So that was June 6th, 1978. And it was funny, somebody sent me a quote that said right after it passed, Jerry Brown was quoted. He said, "I don't see Prop 13 lasting for more than a year." So we've proven Governor Brown wrong. I think we're proving a lot of the progressives in California wrong. And I think one of the reasons for that is that even though California, as you know, John, is far more progressive than it was back in 1978, this is no longer the California of Ronald Reagan, George Duke Majan, or Pete Wilson. This is a decidedly left-leaning state now. And yet, Prop 13, we know from polling, including PPIC, that if Prop 13 were on the ballot today, it would pass by about the same margin as it did back in 1978. So, and the reason for that is there's wide-based bipartisan support. Republicans certainly, Democrats, independents, minority organizations who know very well the devastating impact of losing Proposition 13. So it remains popular to this day, and we really appreciate the partnership we've had with the business community and especially NFIB, because we've stood shoulder to shoulder on so many of these fights.
And yet it seems that it's constantly under assault. Certainly, I've always thought of Prop 13 as being sort of the bastion that makes the American dream possible with the predictability in what your property taxes are going to be over the long term without respect to sort of getting caught up in the vicissitudes of the real estate market. How are you dealing with the current assault, Prop 13?
Well, like we always have, we fight the lies and the myths and the dissembling with truth. I mean, we're very strong in terms of responding in thoughtful ways with facts. For example, the argument that somehow Proposition 13 decimated public education in California is foolish. We are now spending significantly more on a per student inflation adjusted basis than we were prior to Proposition 13. And so we present the facts. The fact, the argument that Prop 13 somehow decimated local government financing, of course, is also false. Prop 13 does a lot of benefits for local governments, including stabilizing local government revenue streams against the big problem in California, which is revenue volatility. So Prop 13 is good tax policy. It not only saved California homeowners and businesses, but it also stabilized revenue for local governments and protected, you know, and provided significantly higher than average property taxes relative to other states. California ranks 14th out of 50 states in per capita property tax collections.
I find the education argument to be sort of the most ludicrous. I think we spend somewhere around $23,000 per pupil.
Wow.
And they think that's not enough.
Tim, that's
and I think even 12, 13 years ago, that was $6,000 or $7,000 per pupil. So this is a little over a decade. That's a tripling of an increase in spending on per pupil. And to say that we need to sort of repeal Prop 13 because that's not enough feels extremely foolish. And I don't think you can say that with a straight face.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true. In fact, in a column I just wrote for the Orange County Register, it was a point counterpoint against one of these left-leaning groups. I pointed out that even the president of CTA said that they've tripled per pupil spending in the last 4 years. So we're just throwing that fact right back in their face.
Hey, John, since we're talking about spending by our illustrious state leaders, otherwise known as the Drunken Sailor Caucus, you know, let's jump right into California's fiscal affairs. You know, look, we right now at the time of this podcast, we're in the middle of 2023. We went from a flush multi-billion dollar budget surplus to a gigantic sea of red in the multi-billions again. John, how did this happen? I mean, who's to blame and what's anybody doing about this? Or is anybody doing about this under the Capitol Dome?
Well, a lot of problems with the revenue flow. First of all, as you know, the budget process is completely broken. We have no state budget in reality. What we have is a 365-day rolling spending process, and that was the direct result of an initiative passed many years ago that was supposed to bring transparency and timeliness to the state budget. It did the exact opposite. So even the LAO, legislative analyst, Gabe Pettick, has started calling the deficit a problem rather than a deficit. Now, he got criticized for that, but I don't criticize him for that. In fact, I have pretty high regard for our legislative analyst. He's a very smart guy. But the reason he did that is because we don't know. Whether we have a deficit depends on spending assumptions, which nobody thought those spending assumptions were realistic. So that's why you went from the $95 billion surplus to a $25 billion deficit or problem, is because the revenue wasn't coming in like they thought it was. And I think the problem is just going to get worse. John, you're NFIB. You have seen your members leave this state in droves. I am seeing my members of Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, many who are retirement, but they have decent pensions. They're moving out too. They're taking their taxes with them. And I think this is going to inure to the detriment of the state of California, the extent to which California is making it very difficult for individuals and taxpayers to stay here.
Yeah, it also seems like part of the issue is not knowing what the revenue stream is. Mm-hmm. Normally, we know what the income tax revenue stream is at this point in time, but because they pushed the date back to October, that's a big uncertainty as well.
Well, I was just going to say, you're absolutely right. And my guess is those numbers in October are going to be disappointing, to say the least.
Question for both you, Tim, and for you, Jonathan, is, you know, again, we're mid-year 2023. We're in the, you know, kind of in the throes of budget discussions, negotiations. I mean, is there any hope? Are you seeing anything, Tim, in these discussions? Jonathan, what are you seeing? You guys seeing anything, hearing anything about, you know, any glimmers of hope for some at least budget relief? Or are they just still on their way swimming in the sea of red and adding more to the sea of red?
Well, what I think is I see the transit people demanding $5 billion for transit systems that aren't moving people. All they are is rolling homeless encampments. And so you've got regular commuters not getting on MTA or BART, and because it's unsafe, it's dirty, and these people want $5 billion for failing transportation systems. That makes no sense.
I know the governor had rejected a Senate proposal to increase taxes. They had claimed that it was going to be helping small business. NFIB strenuously opposed it because even though they claimed it as a tax on the big corporations, we knew that a lot of these small businesses file as S-corps. But in addition to that, so much, as Tim has said, you know, trickles down onto Main Street no matter what. Is the governor seems to be a little more of the adult in the room when it comes to some of these tax measures. Is there some truth to that these days, John? Or is there politics involved? And is there a safeguard there?
Well, you know, we do go out of our way to applaud him when he does something good. And there have been a few instances where he has been relatively good. But our concerns are, I think he is not focused on the day-to-day governance of the state of California, as evidenced by the fact that he's proposing a new constitutional amendment to restrict gun rights at the federal level. I mean, you know, that not only is that politically a non-starter, but it borders on the absurd. And then he's in this running gunfight, not literally, but with Republican governors on how great California is. I think the guy certainly has the intellect to focus on California, and I think a lot of people would like him to do that. Mm-hmm. So he has been known. So in answer to your question, it's all relative, John. Yes, he has stopped some of the absolutely crazy Marxist stuff, but that's kind of a low bar. And so it's going to be interesting to go forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we're kind of hanging by the gossamer thread of presidential aspirations here, you know, that what's preventing the wealth tax is he wants to run for president. This new constitutional amendment is obviously an indicator that he has his at least one foot in that ring. Whether it's, you know, whether it's this year or not, I don't know. But I think he needs to be or wants to be seen as being ready should something happen.
I think that's right. I think there are a lot of people who, you know, are looking at Joe Biden and referring to the actuarial tables and figure this guy is not going to make it for another 4 years. He is clearly impaired. I'm not going to say he's Alzheimer's or anything like that, but it's our current president is clearly impaired and does not have the youth and vigor that he didn't. And none of us would at his age. So I think a lot of the Democrats are looking at that. I mean, this assumption that it's going to be Trump versus Biden, I think my guess is that neither one of them will be ultimately on the ticket, but we'll have to wait to see how that goes. But that election is going to be so important because I do believe so much hangs in the balance for California, because if the federal government turns its ship around, it's going to make it more difficult for California to pursue these ultra-progressive policies that are not in the best interest of anybody.
So should I can keep my Kupal for president bumper sticker still on the back of my Jag? That's okay?
No, you have to burn those right now.
You know, speaking of election year stuff, let's talk initiatives for a bit. We'd like to get into a little bit of some of the things that you're, you know, we know there's one that you've been fiercely supporting and has qualified for 2024, November. But before we do that, John, one of the things that I mentioned that you had been involved in and Jarvis had been involved in is Prop 26. Can you remind listeners about Proposition 26, what that meant for, you know, in terms of taxpayer rights? And I that was one I didn't include, but I thought maybe you'd touch upon that and kind of how has that played out since the voters approved?
Well, Prop 26 was one of the many initiatives supported by taxpayers and the business community to close some of the loopholes in Proposition 13. Remember, this has been a 45-year fight, push and pull between the forces on the private sector and government forces and their and those interests that that live off of government largesse. We started with Prop 13, 1978. Then we went to Prop 62 to close some of those loopholes in the definition of what is a special tax, what is a special district. And then we had Prop 218, which has been a remarkable success to limit the use, to stop the abuses of so-called benefit assessment districts. And then Prop 26 was supposed to redefine and provide clarity between what is a fee and what is a tax. And regrettably, I do not believe that Prop 26 was drafted well enough to prevent abuse and the creation of further loopholes. So that is why we have proposed, and it's going to be on the ballot, the Taxpayer Protection and Government Accountability Act, which will be on the 2024 ballot, really closing many of these loopholes. What is a fee? What is a tax? To what extent does a ballot label have to make clear that a tax increase is a tax increase? We mandate that. If there's a ballot measure that increases revenue, they have to say so. And then many other provisions. For example, the one provision that polls absolutely off the chart is the provision that requires that any statewide tax approved by the legislature also has to go to the voters for approval. And everybody recognizes that the gas tax that is so unpopular never would have passed the electorate, even though it passed with a two-thirds margin in the California legislature. So it's to prevent that kind of abuse from happening. There's a lot of good stuff in the Taxpayer Protection and Government Accountability Act, and that's going to be a major, major fight, John, probably on a par with the split role initiative in terms of resources that are going to be required to push that over the finish line.
Yeah, congratulations on that. I think getting the signatures is amazing to get that qualified. Job well done.
Definitely.
Yeah, this could be a sea change. I like the two-thirds vote majority portion going to the people, I think, is massive. And I think that is a creates a possibility for some sort of course correction in California on overspending in the Capitol.
John, does this measure also include, am I correct, an accountability measure in terms of that it must be earmarked specifically for intended, those taxes or fees must be earmarked and directed for the intended use? And if not, legal action could ensue or some accountability could ensue? Is that still in there? Or do
yeah,
you know?
I mean, we already have, you know, there are all these promises and ballot measures that it shall be used for police, fire, and everything else. And it ends up being used for trips to Hawaii or Tahiti or something like that. So what this does is it requires that the money be spent on the specific matters designated in the ballot measure. But more importantly for us legal people, it provides a private right of action to enforce that provision. Mm. So if there is misspending, then somebody could walk into court and sue. Right now, as we've seen, for example, in the litigation over the high-speed rail project, we came in and we said, look, judge, they promised X, Y, and Z. It's right there in the ballot pamphlet, and it's right there in the statute, and they're not spending the money. They're not hitting any of their benchmarks. This thing is invalid, and the judge was like, eh, it's close enough. You know, it's close enough for government work. That's wrong. When our political leaders represent something to the people, either a tax increase or a bond measure, they need to be held accountable in court if necessary to enforce the use of that money for the specific purposes designated.
You know, we hear from our NFIB members, and I talk to everyday Californians, whether they're on the left or the right, and they do say, look, I don't mind the right level of taxes, sensible taxes, fees, et cetera. I just want to know where the heck it's going. And most of the time, I don't. And most of the time, it's not going, I find, where it is supposed to go. So that private right of action done right and used in the right way for once in California, that sure would be a breath of fresh air. Hey, John, and on that note, kind of a question to you. You know, I know you've been a big – I characterize you and Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association as tax fighters. But let me ask you this. Are all taxes, are all fees, levies, the devil out there? I mean, are they all demonized in your eyes? I mean, what level of taxes and costs that must come out of a Californian's pocket do you think – are acceptable? I mean, not just to Jarvis members and to you, but just to voters. Where is that line, and what are your thoughts there?
We'll be right back with more right after this.
Hi, I'm James Beckwith, President and CEO of Five Star Bank. We are excited to help bring you this series of podcasts focused on small business concerns in conjunction with the NFIB. When Five Star Bank was founded in 1999, it was business and community leaders, local entrepreneurs, who wanted to create the sort of personalized banking services they desired themselves. Services inspired by partnership and defined by shared vision and goals. A true understanding of the needs of small business owners. I know a meaningful relationship with a banker can be hard to find. At Five Star Bank, we are responsive, understand your business, and are committed to your success. We want to be a part of your growth and a valued partner supporting your vision and your dreams. You'll find direct access to a banker, complete online and mobile business banking you need to succeed. As an SBA preferred lender, let us help you with your startup business or existing business. If you're looking to make a change, please give us the opportunity to demonstrate what our personalized banking services could mean for you. I promise you individual attention from our colleagues who understand your business and are as committed to your success as you are. You can find us online at fivestarbank.com.
Well, first of all, we have to recognize what that great jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes said, that taxes are the price we live for living in a civilized society. And that is true. But he would be spinning in his grave right now if he saw the tax burden in California. We have the highest income tax rate in America at 13.3%. We have the highest state sales tax rate in America. We have the highest gas tax in America. And even with Prop 13, we rank 14th out of 50 states in per capita property tax collections. We are a high tax state by any measure. But I think even progressives should be appalled at the extent to which the money's not being used wisely. We can have debates over the proper size of government, but liberals and conservatives should agree that the money that is collected should be used in the most efficient, effective way possible. And one thing we'd like to see is the programs that are no longer fulfilling a purpose should be terminated. I think progressives should agree with that as well. So obviously, California is going to want more government programs than Mississippi or Florida, okay? We get that. But California has evolved wasting taxpayer dollars to an art form. And one need only look at the EDD scandal, $32 billion worth of fraud, to understand that is true.
Yeah.
Are there any bills out there that you're particularly keen on taking a look at or discussing? I mean, one that comes to mind for me is AB 421. I think I've seen you write something about that. Can you talk about that bill and how pernicious it is and what it will do to the initiative process?
Well, there's the attacks on the initiative process are legion. Our political elites view any exercise of direct democracy as an affront to their power. And so I believe 421 is the one that would make it very, very difficult to qualify a referendum.
Correct.
And look, referenda are a way, unlike an initiative, which is initiated by citizens, it's a citizen-initiated process, a referenda is something that it just says, legislature, we're going to put a timeout on your bill, and we're going to put it to the people. And it's been successful. I mean, there have been a number of referenda to stop out-of-control government, and there's one right now which I think we'll support. I don't think we've come out officially, but the one that would decimate the fast food industry, just trying to unionize fast food workers in the most absurd Leninist policy. So anyway, the referendum power, this is how they get us. The tools of direct democracy are intended to break an entrenched power elite. That's been the way since 1911 when Hiram Johnson pursued direct democracy as a means to break the power of the railroads. Today, it's the power of the tax eaters, and that's mostly public sector labor organizations. So we defend vigorously the direct democracy rights because, quite frankly, that's one of the few things that our side can use to effectively change policy in the state of California.
Yeah, and you're right about 421. It is the bill that would require 10% of the signatures that are gotten be done or be collected by volunteers. So unpaid volunteers. So it's right. really it's really kind of a clever way for the unions to say it's very challenging for the private sector to be able to do that. Like it would have been very difficult for you guys to do the Taxpayer Protection Accountability Act in that manner. But it's easy for, say, for example, SEIU to do that because they can take time off and they are technically deemed to be unpaid volunteers. So it's definitely an attempt to prevent, as you call, direct democracy.
Yeah.
Well, surprisingly, under 421, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association would be one of the few organizations that would meet that threshold. When we tried to repeal the death tax, we got 400,000 signatures using 100% volunteers. So in a weird way, 421 wouldn't hurt our efforts, but it would help with that. But it would hurt a lot of our allies in the business community because they don't have the access to that. I would suspect if something like 421 would pass, I suspect that many of our allies would probably rely even more on the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association to help them with the volunteer efforts. But I don't think we should even go there. I think we should do what we can to kill 421.
And I was just going to say, we definitely need to referend that fast food measure and that bill. I'll be damned if I'm going to pay $30 for my filet of fish and shamrock shake, John Kupal. I'm not doing it. Speaking of cooking, what else is cooking right now with Howard Jarvis? What do you guys got going besides? I know you're focused on certainly this legislative session, 2023. You're certainly looking ahead at next year and that important measure. What else is in the works or anything you got going? And what can our listeners know about and also engage in if there's anything?
Sure. It's no surprise that we're going to make another run at repealing the death tax. The death tax was the bad part of Proposition 19, which took away the ability of parents and grandparents to convey property to their kids without triggering a massive reassessment. We moved Senate Constitutional Amendment number 4, supported by Senator Kelly Cerito, who did a wonderful job. We had a lot of Democrat support. Jeff Prang, the progressive assessor from LA, was on our side, but it wasn't quite enough to push it over the finish line. So we will be making another run at qualifying an initiative, and we now have an army of volunteers to do this, and we have a few more financial resources, and I think people now are coming to the realization of how bad that was. Mm-hmm. I mean, after Prop 19 passed, people were shocked at what it actually did, and so we may have two initiatives on the ballot in 2024, John.
That's awesome. And, you know, you talk about just mobilizing people. I mean, I want to tell you, John, I want to applaud you. I mean, you have been a great partner with us at NFIB. I mentioned that 200,000 member number, just astonishing, but not surprising. What advice do you have for our small business members out there? I mean, I'm not looking for your trade secrets, maybe a little bit, but, you know, just really just kind of on people who sit there in their little small businesses who feel like I can't make a difference. What can I possibly do? Is there hope? One guy said, I feel like I'm swimming upstream in peanut butter in California. But, you know, what's your advice, John? You do a great job of mobilizing people. But, you know, when you got a lot of small business owners out there and others just to feel apathetic, what's your advice?
Well, I think one of the challenges for you is that small business owners workers are busy. They put in 16-hour days, and they probably feel as though they don't have time to engage in politics. But I think the thing we have to remind everybody, including small business owners, is that in our democratic system, they are supposed to be the bosses. And they need to not only be the bosses of their own employees, but also view their role as being bosses of our elected officials. And they need to hold elected officials accountable. And they can do that through the NFIB, which is a good focal point for their activism. So they don't have to do everything. They can rely on your organization, John, to fight for them in the Capitol like we do.
And at the local level. Petition your government at the local level, too. I think that's where a lot gets done.
Very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and, you know, there's no reason it has to be either or. I think, you know, for those small business owners out there, they should be involved with NFIB. We're fighting fiercely for them at the state and federal level. You know, there's great local organizations like chambers for them to be involved in. But, you know, as taxpayers, they should definitely be involved with Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. I mean, we're looking for that 200,001 member. Plus, then we'll have more added. But you've got a lot more than that, too. But, John, maybe on that note, as we're kind of wrapping up, tell us a little bit about how can people get more involved with Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association? Anything you got championing that you'd like to mention? Just what's going on and let people know.
Yeah. First of all, I think the first thing people should know is that our website isn't just a join here website. It has tons of information on our legislative agenda. It has all kinds of taxpayer action tools, how to properly frame a Public Records Act request, how to do a local initiative to repeal a utility user tax. Our website is constantly updated, and people give us a lot of credit for just pushing a lot of information out there. I would also just say people should join their local Taxpayers Association in Sacramento. It's SACTAX. Ventura has a great one. LA now has a good Taxpayers Association. So join your local Taxpayers Association. We work with all those groups and just network. And as a small business person, John, I know you appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm from Southern California, LA, Glendale area. And I used to go to the Rose Parade and sit on the side of the curb there early mornings watching those parades. You can't afford to sit on the curb. You got and watch things go by. You got to be in there. And I was in the parade once. I actually got to carry a banner as an Eagle Scout, but that's probably more than your listeners want to hear on this. So, hey, John Kupal, thank you so much. Tim Taylor, great to have you in the studio with us. This has just been a great discussion. We just love what you do. We want to encourage everybody out there, be involved with NFIB, NFIB.com, but definitely be involved with Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. What's your website again, John, just so people can join?
Is hjta.org, hjta.org.
Excellent. Any final words before we close out, John Kupal? Grateful to have you here, man.
No, just thank you for the opportunity, John. I'm sure we'll be engaged in many battles going forward.
Awesome. Great to have you, my friend. Good discussion, and we'll look forward to having you come back if you'll do that.
Sounds good. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, everyone, and thanks so much, Jonathan Kupal and Tim Taylor. Take care.
Thank you, John Kupal, for your thoughts and insights for this podcast. Again, we'd like to thank Five Star Bank for its generous support of this and future podcasts. You can learn more about Five Star at fivestarbank.com. You can find all NFIB California podcasts at nfib.com/ca/podcasts. That's nfib.com/ca/podcasts. You can also find our podcast on your favorite podcast app by searching NFIB California. I would also like to thank MultiPoint Content Strategies for its production of this podcast. You can learn more about them at multipointstrategies.com. Why podcasts for small business? It has been NFIB's educational mission for 80 years to remind policymakers that small businesses are not smaller versions of big businesses, and that a one-size-fits-all rule, regulation, or tax can do Main Street enterprises more harm than good. We hope these podcasts aid in better understanding. Finally, thank you to our listeners. If you liked what you heard, please share this episode, subscribe, and give us a positive rating. We would appreciate it.